Right now, I would like to introduce Barbara Crowe. We heard a little bit from her the last conference call. And Barbara is going to talk today a little bit about the lesson plan that you had on sound and acoustics. Then after that, she's going to talk about populations. And then she's going to talk about her book. And so I'm going to turn this over to Barbara, and she'll be asking some questions. Anytime she asks a question, if you would be kindly just push number one on your keypad or on your telephone, then I'll be able to call upon you. So right now, Barbara, I'm going to turn this over to you.
Okay. Well, good afternoon or evening or night or where whatever it is where you are, hearing about snow melting and warming temperatures, I just want to let you know it's been extremely sunny and probably will be 90 degrees tomorrow here in Phoenix. So that's a kind of typical Phoenix winter for us. So, and we would just adore some mud since we get so little rain. Well, that has nothing to do with what we're going to talk about today. I was looking at the videos that you looked at, and of course the first thing I thought is, when was that taken and where is that dress that I was wearing? But I hope that you can envision me as we're talking. I don't look too much different than when those were taken. And I want to start out with any questions or comments you have about that material that you saw on the 10 video clips about acoustics and psychoacoustics. Acoustics being the study of the science of sound, and psychoacoustics being the study of the perception of sound and the elements of sound. So let's start and see if anybody has any questions or something they'd like to discuss at this point.
So, Barb, I'm looking for people to raise their hands with comments. And while I'm waiting for those to come in, I had a question from Cheryl Kissling ahead of time. And she wanted to know about the European tuning in 438, that she heard that it was more physiologic than 440. Do you have any take on about the tuning, the frequency information?
Yeah, I don't quite know what she means by physiologic. I mean, does that mean it matches some kind of bodily rhythm, or does it match an energetic field, or, you know, I'm not really sure what she means. And in fact, I have heard a little bit about some interest, not so much research, but some people saying that there is a frequency around 440 that's better than 440, the American A tuning system. I don't know the specifics of that, unfortunately, and I think it doesn't, you know, you have to understand that mainstream science and mainstream medicine is not dealing with energy and energy medicines, and we'll kind of get into that when we talk about my book. So any research isn't coming out of the medical field. Even the neurocognitive scientists who are studying music in the brain wouldn't be going there, you know, this frequency for A is better than another. At the moment, I think the best way to think about it is all tuning systems, all scales, including the Pythagorean, all, you know, deciding what note a what vibration a particular note has is completely arbitrary. At the moment, we don't know that one is better or worse, or there's a natural inner, I mean, it's all human invention, and it's all just humans just trying to cope and to find a scale and a tuning system that makes practical music making possible. I do think it's an area to be aware of and to be looking at, and a lot of that will be coming out of perhaps the Oriental medicines and some of that filtering into our awareness. But even if you say it's better physiologically, is it better physiologically for every person? Or would it be different based on their energy system, their height, their weight, you know, et cetera, et cetera? I think it's a little hard to say that a 100-pound woman and a 250-pound man has the same, quote-unquote, physiological tone, and we should tune our A's to that. I just don't think it works that way. It's much too individualized for that. I mean, you're learning to find the resonant tone of each patient that you work with. but you're finding that tone for each person. You're not saying this A is the resonant tone. So I think it's an interesting area. There'll probably be more research on it, but right now I don't think that I would say any different tuning of A is better than the other.
Right, right. I remember at the music therapy conference in San Diego, there was a man there who had sort of like an egg-shaped chair that you sat in.
Mm-hmm.
And he took, for instance, I had my CD there, and he said, let me run this through, and you sit in this chamber with it, A440, and then I'm going to bring it down to A438. And I have to say, it really had a different effect on me. What kind of effect it had, I can't quite say. But the music did sound quite richer for me.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought it was interesting what he was purporting to do.
Mm-hmm. And I did that, but to a Beatles song.
Did you?
No, I don't have a CD, so he used a Beatles song and did that. And it did sound different. Whether it affected me differently, that I don't know. But if you're talking about the subtle energy levels, I wouldn't overtly say, ooh, you know, that affected me in some way. So.
Right, right.
We're into an area where traditional research doesn't work very well.
Right. I have a whole collection of about 50 people here that are very shy tonight because nobody's raised their hand.
Nobody has any questions. Huh?
But let's see if we can get something started here. I have a little bit of a question. I was driving along today in the car, and not beknownst to the California police, I was actually talking on the telephone. And I had my speakerphone on, and somebody put me on hold. And the music was so loud on there, and I didn't want to finagle with trying to figure out how to turn it down. And one of the things that I did was to put my telephone next to my leg to try to muffle it because it was so loud. And
mm-hmm.
I thought back to this a piezoelectric effect of how music affects the body, the sound
mm-hmm.
waves coming to the body. And I literally had this impression that this sound was burning a hole in my leg. It was so loud.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just wondering a little bit if something like that, something like that could be harmful. Probably not, but it felt like it was at the moment.
Well, it almost sounds like, here's a little review of some of the things around the tapes. If the amplitude was loud, was big enough, because when you're so loud, you're getting a big physical wave, because amplitude is the bigness of the sound wave, and that is right next to your skin, or, at least through cloth. Those big sound waves are directly trying to get your cells to vibrate, because through resonance, the cells are going to vibrate. And if they're vibrating too big, you could hurt them. You could get a bruise, for example, because maybe you would burst some of those cells, and they would bleed out into the surrounding tissues. Now, I think it would take quite a bit of time and quite a bit of amplitude to do that, but it is conceivable that that could happen. Now, whether it's long-term, you're going to get cancer on your thigh, that I don't know. But it's, too big a sound wave can certainly hurt your ears, and blow out your eardrums, the inner ear, the cochlea in particular, and certainly cause hearing damage or loss of hearing. But it, we don't really know if really loud acoustic sound vibrations concentrated and over time could in fact be disrupting organ systems, or at least the energy system. And certainly I think we would say it could disrupt the energy system.
Mm-hmm.
If it, it depends on the frequency, which is how fast the sound wave is going. Notice I'm reviewing all this stuff in this answer. It also, if you got the right frequency, it could help. Because when you're wanting to, for example, when they use sound to explode kidney stones, for example, or something like that. They have to find the right frequency based on the size and the density of the stone. Once they find the right frequency that that little stone likes to vibrate at, will vibrate larger, then they irradiate that frequency loudly to that area of the body. And what happens is that little hard stone starts to vibrate, and because it's a solid, it'll break apart into smaller pieces so that you can pass the smaller pieces more easily with less pain than the bigger piece. But so if it was a frequency that was beneficial to the body, then but it would be a real shot in the dark, you know, with music playing over a phone.
Well, it certainly, I just had this very visualized little hole on my body, and I thought to myself, well, that certainly is not my resonant frequency that's going into my leg right then.
Yes.
Jan Hirsch, I'm going to give you the mic right now. Just a moment. There you go, Jan.
Well, you know, I just wanted to remind everyone that loud music is used as a torture method, and it was used just recently as a torture method. So I know that's not about vibrating against the skin, right on the skin, but it certainly is a horrible thing to do to human beings, and it is used as a torture method to play very loud music constantly.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And the other thing that's been documented actually was sound waves being directed toward the enemy in Vietnam during the war, so that when a certain frequency was emitted to them, it caused them to have a bowel movement. So that's something that's actually been documented.
That's very interesting. Was it the E minor mode? I mean, was it the Phrygian mode that caused them to do that?
And again, you know, this E minor mode, I think from what the research I've been doing on that is that it doesn't have to do with that frequency, but it has to do with the mode of the music. In other words, the Phrygian mode is so deep, and it elicits so much feeling and emotion that I think we store a lot of the emotions in our gut. And when people start accessing that emotion, then that's when things start to churn in the colon area, because we've actually been doing quite a bit of work with Phrygian in different keys. So some people would say the E is the frequency that's going to vibrate the colon, and yet I think it's more the mode. Do you have any comment on that, Barb?
I think based on, you know, what you've been doing, I think it probably is the mode more than the per se key. Of course, you know, from my discussion last time we were on a call, you know that as a music therapist, we don't really believe that the music itself is the agent of change or the agent of therapy. And so though I am interested in sound healing topics, and Tina and I work together on the Sound and Music Alliance and all that, I am not as up on a lot of that sound healing research as others are, because, you know, we more look at the experience of the music as the effect of an external agent, i.e. the music, on the functioning of the patient or the client. But I think you're gathering quite a bit of evidence for the fact that it's more the mode than it is a particular key. Now, Rudolf Steiner would have said it is the tone and the intervals. Of course, intervals would imply a mode, you know, arrangement of intervals. But he was very specific in talking about tone and specific tones for particular days of the week and seasons of the year, and to approach a particular problem in someone that you're working with. So he very strongly felt it was the tone or the key.
Gaylord, you have the mic right now.
I have a comment and a question. The with the pitches causing a bowel movement, I know way back years ago when I was in college, There was an organist at one of the conferences I went to that an organ company was trying to make extremely low pitches on the organ, and they found that had the same results, extremely low pitches, because they wanted the octave basso an octave or two octaves lower, and that wasn't good for the audience, so to speak, because it's also, and that was extremely low pitches. They didn't say what the names of the pitches were, so I don't know what, can't relate it to mode that way. But I had a question, too, and it goes back to the quiz. I watched your video several times, and the number three, what four things are needed to be present for sound to be projected? I only could find three of them, and I had vibration or displacement. That, I think, is the same one. And medium of transmission, which would be either air or water, and the receiver. Now, I didn't get the fourth one. I just did it several times.
Okay.
Do I have...
Exactly. The four things that have to be present for you to perceive sound, because the term sound is a term of perception. The acoustic term is acoustic wave. That happens no matter what, as long as there's a vibrating body, something to vibrate,
okay.
Energy put in the system, so like plucking a string, plucking your harp strings, a medium of transmission, that's the one that you were missing. So that's air or water or a solid, something to move that from the source to the person who's going to perceive it, and then you have to have a perceiver or a receiver.
Right. I missed the energy one. I guess I forgot you had to pluck the string.
That's right. The most obvious one is the easiest one.
Right. Thank you.
You're welcome. With those low tones, I do feel from the resonant kinesiology program that the lower sounds do resonate with the larger cavities of the body, and so that would certainly have more of an effect on the colon than, let's say, the nervous system of the brain. Let's say we were able to actually do many exercises with Susan Borg and feel that in the body, so that makes a lot of sense. And Jan Hirsch, you have the mic right now.
I just wanted to, we were talking about the question about digital sound, and it was question number 8. Why are recordings never true representations of the real instruments now that they are digital? I think that's the question that someone wanted to know the answer to.
Right, I have that in front of me. The answer is it's never a full spectrum of sound like an acoustic instrument, and it is not geared toward the patient. Barb, would you like to say anything more about that?
Yeah, well, when they record digitally, what they do is they sample frequencies, you know, from the very low, the medium low, the middle. In other words, they don't reproduce all the possible frequencies, which would encompass particularly the overtones, because those get higher and higher. So, You're not getting the full spectrum of sound that is actually produced in an acoustic instrument, and particularly an instrument like the harp, because, as in the video, see, I did watch these again, the harp spans such a large range of fundamental frequencies that it also then produces, it, with each of those fundamentals, a richness of the overtones. But when you do digital recordings, they don't record all of that. They just sample out certain ones. So you never get the fullness of the frequency presentation on a digital recording that you do with a live instrument.
And one of the things that was mentioned on this is that the guided imagery music uses recordings, but those recordings have a full spectrum of voices and that they use in psychiatric units. So that's kind of one of the things that the guided imagery music people use.
Well, they did back when they were on tapes. Nowadays they're using CDs, so they are using digitalized sound.
Okay. Jan Hirsch, I'm not sure if I just didn't put her hand down. Jan, did you have another question?
Actually, Tina, it must be a psychic connection here, because I wanted to say something, but I didn't want to interrupt any further. But I did have something I wanted to share with everyone. I heard a fascinating piece of information tonight about music and research. It was happening at McGill University in Canada, and it was with the piano. And they found that slight variations in timing had a profound emotional effect on people, that was the most emotionally pleasing, that a robotic, perfectly timed sound is not an emotional connection. It's when an artist uses slight variations in the rhythm of a piece, where one note might be held for a fraction of a second longer than another note. In other words, not perfect metronome timing, but more artistic timing is much more pleasing to the human being, and the human being can connect much more readily emotionally with that variation in timing of a great artist.
Hallelujah, boy.
That's
what I'm always looking for in my students playing, is that emotion quality instead of...
We call it musicality.
That's right. So you want to address that, Barb?
Yes, because you know what they're doing there? They are adding complexity to the rhythms. They're adding a slightly chaotic element to the music. It fits a basic pattern, but it isn't strict. And that's how our world is, and that's what we respond to. We're going to go over the book a little bit and talk about complexity science here towards the end. But that's exact, and they found the same thing in human functionings. Like the classic one is the heartbeat. You know, our hearts do not beat in a simple love dub, love dub, love dub. They keep that basic shape, but the whole time it's going through the love dub kind of pathway, it is shimmering with movement. They call that heart variability. And if you're listening now to news of things, you're hearing about heart variability as being a measure of the health of the heart. If the heart gets too close to that simplistic love-dub, you're headed towards heart failure. They want to see a high level of heart variability. And that's the same thing in the rhythm. If we have just this strict metronomic kind of rhythm, it is unnatural, because our world is not like that. And so when you have these slight variations, what the musician is doing is putting complexity into the system and pushing that towards a more recognizable and emotional response in the people who are listening. So that makes complete sense to me.
So, Barb, so with Thomas Wynn's presentation on heart math that we have up on our website, what it seems to me that we're doing is that we're trying to create a more even heart rate variability in order to put people into the zone. Is that not correct?
I don't think so, because I think the whole idea of heart math is to increase your heart variability. No.
Okay.
So I don't know. I'll have to talk to him about it. But I know all the cardiologists who are working now with this idea of complexity in the movement of an organ like the heart says the more variability, the better, because then you have a lot of movement with which the heart can right itself if it needs to. You know, if you have a very simplistic heartbeat and someone scares the heck out of you, your heart will go wildly off and may not be able to right itself back. But if you have a lot of this shimmering movement, that edge of chaos dynamics I talk about in the book, if they're startled, it'll jolt a little out of the pattern, but it'll have something to work with to come back into its normal trajectory, its normal pattern. But I'll speak with our colleague about that.
Okay. Well, maybe it's just the way I'm interpreting the wavelength there. Okay. Well,
I think the simplicity is in brainwaves.
Okay.
I think that then opens your heart. I think that's what it is.